Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, another small Massachusetts liberal arts college is closing. Some Newbury College parents say they feel duped because they were recruited from Mount Ida College right before it closed.
I think if they had known that they were in financial difficulty, why would they come and prey on Mount Ida students knowing that they had already gone through this once?
Also today, a new book about life in the classroom with the late Elie Wiesel.
He was a globe-trotting Nobel Prize winner who's getting phone calls from presidents and prime ministers, but he met with every student in his class for at least 10 minutes in the semester one-on-one.
Plus, Chef Lydia Bastianich takes a culinary tour of rural America.
I think that there's the strength of these different ethnicities belonging all to the great country that is America. And food is a glue, an element that binds us.
That's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Another small Massachusetts liberal arts college will shut its doors. Newbury College, a 625-student school in Brookline, announced last week that it's closing after the spring semester. For some students, this was a double whammy because they had been recruited from Mount Ida College in Newton, which closed this spring. 19-year-old Samantha Marshall, an interior design student, is among them. When Newbury approached her as Mount Ida closed, she says she asked Newbury College officials specifically about the school's finances, and she says she was assured that the school was on sound financial footing. In fact, Marshall says Newbury admissions officers referred her to the website GuideStar, which lists nonprofits' financial information. In an email, the admissions office said, quote, Newbury College carries almost no debt, which allows it to operate comfortably. Earlier today, we spoke with Samantha's mother, Barbara Marshall, who says her family, especially her daughter, are in shock.
She got her grades on Thursday night. She was thrilled. She got 4 A's and a B+. One of the teachers had sent her an email thanking her for her participation in class. You know, she was really, really happy. And the school waited until they were all on break to tell them, you know. And I think if they had known that they were in financial difficulty, why would they come and prey on Mount Ida students knowing that they had already gone through this once? You know, they only got 4 students from Mount Ida. She specifically asked if they were in any financial difficulty, and they said no.
After what happened at Mount Ida, did you look into the school's finances? Did you look into Newbury's finances?
I mean, we checked them out at GuideStar because it says, you know, gives their financials and says that there are no closures or mergers in the, you know, future.
And when did she get that letter from them?
April 17th.
And then when did she find out that Newbury will be closing after the spring semester?
Friday, after they all left for break.
So
I found out from the article in the Globe. And then she got an email.
The president of Newbury College, Joseph Chillo, you're probably aware that he told the Boston Globe that those comments in that email about the school's finances were not true. He apologized for that. He said he takes responsibility for that. But he also said the email was written by someone who would not have been briefed on the challenges facing the school. What's your reaction to that statement from Newbury College President Chillo?
My reaction is that admissions came to Mount Ida specifically to recruit students. My daughter asked a very specific question about their finances. And the person who responded by email said that they did some research into the subject and gave, you know, their financials and said that they specifically said that there were no mergers or closures in the near future.
Did you know that in March, Newbury President Chillo had publicly said that the school ran a $2.8 million deficit the previous year and was trying to close a budget shortfall?
I did not know that, no.
So
I also had two daughters at Mount Ida, so it was kind of a hectic, you know, we had to find schools for two. And my other daughter was in the funeral program, so that was a mad scramble.
And where did she end up?
She ended up in Canton, New York, 7 hours away, at a state school in New York for more money because she's paying out-of-state tuition.
Did Newbury offer generous financial aid?
They did.
Well, some people might say, you know, a lot of small liberal arts schools are in danger, and they need to recruit as much as possible because that they're a business, too. I know it's not much consolation, but I'm trying to think of what they would probably say to defend themselves.
I think they should have told the truth when she asked the questions. You know, they should, the admissions should have had that information.
What's your advice to other parents?
Look into the financial situation of any school, any prospective schools. I mean, and especially small liberal arts colleges.
And what do you think that they should have done? Mount Ida did close really abruptly. This is a semester notice on the part of Newbury College. I mean, does that help at all? Is there something they could have done to make it easier if they realized they just can't financially stay afloat?
I think if they knew that they were in danger of closing maybe last year, they should have made a plan with the Board of Higher Education, seeing, you know, in, after seeing what happened with Mount Ida, make a plan to teach out the students that were there. She had just transferred into Mount Ida that semester when it closed. So this is her third school in three semesters. And the first one was by choice, but the second, you know, the other two were not.
That's Barbara Marshall, whose daughter Samantha is looking for another school to transfer to after Newbury College announced that it's closing after the spring semester. Listeners, we want to spend some time talking about this today, and we want to hear from you. What do you think about these schools closing? What's the fate of small liberal arts colleges? Could this situation involving Newbury College have been handled differently? Should there be more oversight? Or are colleges businesses, just like any other business? Do you think that that's the case? Or is there something different about higher education? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining us to talk further about this is Matthew Durr. He's president of Sterling College in Craftsbury Common, Vermont. It's a private environmental college. It has just about 100 students. Hello there, Matthew Durr.
Hello, good afternoon.
Also on the line from California is Talani Britton. She's an assistant professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Education. She also taught at Harvard about the economics of higher ed. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, Deborah.
So, Matthew, I'm going to start with you. What do you make of the Newbury College Admissions Office communicating with the student whose mother we just heard from, with Samantha Marshall, and saying that the school was on sound financial footing and there were no plans for the school to close and there was no debt at all? What do you make of that? Now, we should say again, the president of Newbury College has apologized for that email, but what do you think of it?
Right, right. You know, it is a relationship that has to be based on trust, both in the Office of Admission, the trust that they're getting the information they need about the health and well-being of the institution financially and otherwise, so that they can sustain that trust as they go out and talk to prospective families. So, you know, any college president, any chief admission officer hearing Samantha's story would feel a sense of obligation and a sense of commitment that she should have had the information that she needed. It's, of course, one of the bigger challenges is that some of the small colleges are caught in a sort of catch-22 of trying to sustain their enrollment and generally relying on enrollment and growth for their future. And that has to be done within the context of an ethical conversation within the institution, from the Board of Trustees to the president to those frontline admission people who are, frankly, often people who are out of college in their first year, out talking and promoting their own alma mater and believing deeply in its purpose. Hmm. So it's a complex relationship, but when it veers away from being based in trust, then bad things can happen. I have to acknowledge that I know very little about Newberry College and their circumstance, but I think within the National Association of College Admission Counselors, there is a deep commitment to sort of ethical behavior as colleges, all colleges, reach out to students about the characteristics of the places to which they're applying.
Right. Well, couldn't it have been, though, a misunderstanding? I mean, this admissions email from Newberry College refers Samantha Marshall, the student, to GuideStar.org, the website about nonprofits, financials, and it says, "I have done this research, Samantha Marshall. Look, we are on sound financial footing. GuideStar says that Newberry has a surplus of $2.6 million, and we are okay." I mean, it could have been a misunderstanding on the part of the admissions official who sent this email to give her the benefit of the doubt. And if that's the case, I'm wondering, where can people get objective, accurate information about a school's finances? And what is the school's responsibility to communicate that when, as you say, you know, they have to sustain their enrollment levels?
Absolutely, and there's the question both of the responsibility and the timing of information. For the most part, the tools that are out there for families are backward-looking. They look to past financial reporting audits, 990s, information that may not be as current as the administration may have at their fingertips, or may not have seeped into the conversations of the admission office if it wasn't directly part of the communication from the finance offices and the leadership of a college. So I think, you know, college is different than buying a product. I mean, we all have deep emotional connections to our undergraduate experience in particular, but a deep sense of belonging and connection. But having said that, I think that families are going to have to look closely at other characteristics, other qualities of an institution in almost real time to understand the whole picture so that they can enter into those conversations with admission officers knowledgeably and encourage the kind of candid communication that they should be providing to families.
I want to say we spoke today with Barbara Brittingham, the president of the New England Commission on Higher Education, the accrediting body involved here, and she said, you know, this is a tough situation, but President Joseph Cello at Newberry College handled it, and the board of the school handled it as best they could. Let's listen.
These are hard times, and I think students and parents are becoming more sophisticated about looking at colleges that they may be interested in attending. The commission has increased its availability of public information about colleges, and certainly when Newberry College was placed on probation, that information was made public.
So I wonder, Matthew, saying that a school being on probation is public information, is that enough, and is that too much of an onus on the family here? I mean, are you saying, well, you know, you could have researched it and found out that the school was on probation? I mean, are there other steps that should be taken?
Well, I think that's a special category of a school, and I think that the accreditor is doing their work in real time in a way that is important to families, and that they're certainly protecting families from institutions that they think are in severe financial shape. And ultimately, the burden still rests with the institutions and with the boards and the presidents of these institutions to be clearly communicating about the financial health of their institutions. And I think there are ways, of course, that other criteria that could be more publicly shared with prospective students and families. And then there are matters of perspective and research that families themselves can do if they have concerns. You know, typically looking at characteristics like a turnover of presidents. So Sterling has had three presidents in the last 24 years. That kind of continuity and stability is an indication that an institution might be healthy. Looking at foundations that are giving, rather than individuals, but looking at foundations that are giving, that may be doing the due diligence they need to do in order to make sure that an institution is healthy and thriving. And I think asking questions about growth and frankly, moving into conversations about where does the revenue come from that supports the operation of the college. If it's 90 or 95% from enrollment, then that institution is going to be really in a difficult spot. And I agree with Barbara Brigham that these are difficult times, and Scott Jasek of Inside Higher Education certainly says these are difficult times, but not all small colleges are in retraction. Not all small colleges are under threat, and certainly there are some wonderful liberal arts colleges that, compared to big public universities, would be considered small that are elite and thriving. And so there's quite a bit of diversity out there, and with that diversity comes an opportunity for families to look more deeply into all of the characteristics that might indicate financial health as well as financial vulnerability.
Talani Britton, I want you to sort of follow up on that. What do you think about threats to small colleges right now and what these closings, last I heard the statistic was something like 11 small schools closing every year. Are they under threat, or how would you describe it?
Yes, I mean, I think it's a fair statement to say that many are under threat. To Matthew's point, I think it's also important not to indicate that all are under threat, but I do think that there are ways that consumers and families can find some of that information. One of them, of course, is the annual financial statements. One of the sort of things that I was struck by was reading Newberry College's statement for the sort of fiscal year that ended June 30, 2017, buried in the notes that said management acknowledges uncertainty remains over the ability to sustain the long-term financial stability of the college. So I do think that there's actually quite a lot of information in the financial reports. It is retrospective, and unfortunately, a lot of the burden does seem to be on the family. Some of the other sources of information are the Federal Student Aid website, for example, where they have what are called the financial responsibility composite scores, essentially a score that ranges from -1 to +3, and generally a score of 1.5 or above indicates sort of positive financial health. Mm-hmm. However, it is definitely not a perfect measure. And some sort of recent research has found that about half of colleges that closed received passing scores. In fact, Newberry did have a passing score.
Right. So did Mount Ida before it closed.
And so did Mount Ida, absolutely. So it is not perfect. And so essentially, I feel like given where many small colleges are in terms of some of the demographic shifts that we've seen, particularly in places like the Northeast, it really does behoove a family to do as much research as possible on the financial health of small, particularly less selective liberal arts colleges.
I want to take a call now, and I want to remind listeners that if you have questions or you want to weigh in on the situation of small liberal arts schools closing, you can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Ray is calling from Danvers. Ray, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, in the 80s, I was in a similar situation. The only difference was I was in a small school, Worcester County, Central New England College. It was an engineering school, associate's, bachelor's degree in various engineering disciplines. And there was an embezzlement problem there. And the school went down, and I guess I was lucky enough I was in the last semester, but I was really rushing to get this thing through. I would, you know, with some of these schools that being predatory and everything else, I would think there'd be a way that, you know, the schools could be bonded or almost like underwritten like an insurance company is through the Department of Education in such a manner that, you know, you're offering this, people paying money, there's got to be, you know, you go under, well, there's got to be an alternative or something, because there isn't usually the people pick these places because of convenience, they're working. That's the best alternative, and sometimes there aren't any other alternatives for these people.
Okay, well, let's take that question to Talani Britton. Talani, I'm wondering, you know, what about the accreditation process? And we know, for example, Newberry College was on probation, but it was still accredited. And if you're not accredited, it's my understanding you don't get federal student aid. So it's a big deal to be accredited here. Could there be some sort of mechanism in that accreditation process that might improve accountability or at least protect students?
Well, I think in some ways the accreditation process does have some built-in, once again, protections for students. However, it's not perfect, in part because you have to give institutions time to sort of rectify issues that have been found, right? So we think about the case of Newberry College. They were put on probation, but it was a two-year probation, which essentially said they had 2 years in order to rectify some of the issues that had been found. And so I don't want to say that probation is a death knell for institutions. However, I do believe that it is a warning sign that clearly things are not as they should be with the institution, and so that's something that families should take into account. The federal government does have some oversight, though I wouldn't say that they necessarily have sort of insurance program, but they do require things like letter of credits for schools that have composite scores that are below a certain number.
Mm-hmm. So where do you, I guess, what do you say to those students who are at Newberry College, students like Samantha Marshall and her mom, who we just heard from? I mean, what do you say to them about how they should move forward from this?
Yeah, I think that's a really a great question. In terms of moving forward, it really sounds like they're doing the best they can under the circumstances, and I would argue that sometimes institutions are doing the same thing as well, which is really to re-enroll in another school and ensure that the investment they've made in their education will actually be both complete and provide a return. I would absolutely suggest looking at the financial health of institutions, and beyond things like sort of websites and GuideStar, but really looking, unfortunately, into sort of the actual financial statements, which isn't very, I would say it's a relatively difficult thing for most people to do, right? These things are not written in layman's terms, but given the, as you mentioned previously, Deborah, the number of closures of particularly small, less selective liberal arts colleges, if that is the type of institution a student is seeking, then one of their best bets is really to do a lot more research on the school's financial position. I would also look at things like enrollment over time. We see Newberry College, you know, from the 90s to the present, a really dramatic decline in enrollment from 5,000-plus students to 620-something students. And so it really does require a lot of research on the part of families and students, unfortunately.
And why do you think we're seeing schools like this closing like this right now? What are two of the main factors behind this?
So I would say one of them is definitely the demographics. So just overall across the country, we've seen between about a 1 and a 1.7% decline in enrollment each year. There's been a fall in the fertility rate, certainly since the Great Recession. On the other hand, the relatively strong economy means that non-traditional students who are now a much higher percentage of students enrolled are no longer quite as interested in enrolling in college in this particular economy. So we're really seeing schools being pressed in a number of directions. Firstly, we see this sort of decline in the number of 18 to 24-year-olds who would enroll in college. And we're also seeing declines in the number of non-traditional students and an increasing real reliance on tuition at the same time that we're seeing these decreases in the populations who are even available to attend college. Mm.
Matthew Durr, last word goes to you. What would you say? I mean, how are you surviving in that environment? We've got a minute here. What's the main way that you're making sure that your school stays strong?
Focus on the mission, and we have a unique mission within liberal arts colleges, this focus on environmental stewardship and the critical issues of the day. I think the other variable here is, of course, borrowing and debt that colleges undertake to compete with other colleges. So knowing oneself, knowing your institution, and promoting it in a way that students can distinguish it from other liberal arts colleges is going to be increasingly important going forward.
Okay, Matthew Durr, president of Sterling College in Craftsbury Common, Vermont. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Also from California was Talani Britton, assistant professor at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Education. Thanks so much, Talani.
Thank you, Deborah.
Stay with us. Coming up, a new book about continuing the work of Elie Wiesel. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The late Elie Wiesel survived Nazi death camps and went on to write dozens of books and win the Nobel Peace Prize. But our next guest says Wiesel's life mission was teaching. He taught for almost 40 years at Boston University. Rabbi Ariel Berger knew Wiesel for much of that time. He was his student, teaching assistant, and his friend. Rabbi Berger has written a new book titled Witness: Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. Rabbi Berger, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So many people, I think, know the outline of Elie Wiesel's story. His book, Night, about surviving the Holocaust, is required reading in most classrooms around the country. So folks probably know he was sent to Auschwitz concentration camp in 1944 when he was 15 years old, then transferred to Buchenwald, and the camp was liberated in 1945. So that's sort of the outline. But you knew him, Elie Wiesel, the man, personally. And I wonder, because you write in the book in the very beginning that the first time you met him was when you felt that you were fully seen. What does that mean? What does that tell us about who he was as a person?
Well, I'll start with the very end of Night. If you read Night, if your listeners read Night, the last scene is Elie Wiesel, 15 years old, looking in a mirror, and a corpse is looking back. And so we might be forgiven for thinking that this is a man who will grow up to be a very depressive person. And I knew him as a very joyous person, as a very warm person. And he had a certain presence about him. And so when I met him for the first time, I felt fully seen because he really saw people. He didn't see people as objects or means to an end. He really saw people as, for lack of a better word, as souls. And so I think in his presence, many people reported feeling the same feeling of being fully seen in a unique way.
And how do you think he accomplished that after going through what he went through?
Well, someone asked him that in class once. How did you keep going after the Holocaust? And how did you not lose your sanity or your hope?
Or how did he not become that depressed person, right?
Right. And he said that learning was a major part of that, that process of healing and reclaiming life, and that the process of activating his curiosity and becoming an insatiable reader and learner, encountering many traditions and literatures, somehow helped him to continue and keep going and not become depressed. But he also had a sadness about him, and I think that heaviness of his experiences and also of looking at a world that had not fully learned the lesson of the Holocaust gave him a heaviness as well.
Right. And so that's why he chose to continue as a professor, because education was so important to him.
I think for him, education was so much more than the transmission of information. It was about helping people gather the tools to live an examined life. And so he really believed, when he looked at issues like war, conflict, genocide, torture, policy questions about the death penalty or immigration or anything, that education had to be an essential component of whatever response we develop, because education is what allows us to question ourselves, to encounter others with very different assumptions.
So then how did he deal with the fact that many high-ranking Nazi officials were also well-educated?
That was one of his big questions, right? Education was not a shield to the German people, nor was culture. And so for him, it wasn't just any sort of education. It was a particular kind of education. It was a moral education that centered on what he called memory, which is the act of empathically inhabiting someone else's experience and learning sensitivity as a result, in such a way that through a process of reflection, we as students were transformed in ways that we could quantify or point to specific examples. The way we interacted with homeless people on the street would be different after an encounter in Elie Wiesel's classroom. The way that we related to suffering on the other side of the globe would be different. We would sleep less well as a result of being in his class.
What would be some of the books and things that you think were almost required reading if you were a student of his?
Yeah, he had a vast inner library and an actual library. He preferred books that had outlasted empires. So he
that's the ground rule.
That's one of the criteria. He always went back to the Bible. He loved other religious texts. We studied the Bhagavad Gita and the Quran fairly often. He loved Camus and Kafka and Kierkegaard, people who really wrestled with metaphysics and big questions and big ideas. And he also interspersed that with firsthand accounts of wars and instances of oppression. And those could have been from a long time ago or from the 20th century. He really honored the eyewitness testimonies.
Mm. Were there key tenets of his that you... What were the keys? Do you think we talked about them already?
No, but it's funny. I actually...
With the reading list, we have key tenets?
No, but I wrote for myself, just sort of for fun. I wrote... let me see if I have it here. Yeah, I wrote the Ten Commandments of Elie Wiesel. I haven't shared this anywhere.
Oh, well, let's hear them.
So the first one is listen to a witness to become a witness, which means that you can hear someone else's experience and allow it to change you and carry their story with you wherever you go. Number two is don't kill the dead again, meaning don't forget them. Remember their names. Enter madness if necessary to awaken sleeping communities. You might be perceived as a mad person if you're shouting about things that are wrong in society that everyone else takes for granted. Number four is don't let the enemy define you. That's something he said when asked about his joy. He said, you know, I'm a joyful person because I don't let the enemy define me. If I did, I would be very sad all the time and maybe angry all the time. Mm. But that would be another victimization. He said, any one life is worth more than all that's been written about life. True prophets don't comfort, they disturb. So if we're looking at leaders, that's a good one. If we're looking at leaders and trying to understand who's a genuine leader to follow, they will not just tell us what we want to hear. Remember to laugh in spite of all the darkness. There is always something you can contribute, even if it's just your protest. Worship God by arguing with God. Sometimes there is no meaning, but then we must make meaning. That's number 10.
Yeah, those are lovely. You know, there's a part in the book where you talk about a lot of the questions and answers in Elie Wiesel's classroom at Boston University over the years. And I wonder, is there a particular question? You mentioned that there are some questions that students asked him a lot, such as how do you not become completely destroyed when something is awful as the Holocaust happens to you? But are there other questions that you feel were common questions that were often something that he was discussing in his classes at Boston University?
Yeah, there were several. One question is why? Why would people turn to violence? Why would people oppress other human beings? Why does that happen? He asked that about human beings. He also asked that question about God.
Do you think that this is common in higher education, this method of teaching and of trying to steer students toward self-scrutiny and these sort of deep questions?
In my experience, it's not. It's very countercultural. I think it should be. I think it could be. But I've encountered classrooms in which the teacher or professor is a little bit allergic to those kinds of personal, subjective, reflective questions. And there's an emphasis on mastery of a particular field and the particular tools and methods of that field, as if we are meant to perform a role as objective beings who aren't implicated in what's happening in the world today. And Elie Wiesel's classroom was all about formation, subjectivity. How do I really grow as a sensitive, compassionate actor for justice in the world in small ways and maybe in bigger ways? Mm. And so it always came back to the mirror, the text as a mirror. And we're looking at ourselves ultimately and asking, am I doing enough, and what can I do better? What can I do more to help?
Right. Now, he died in 2016, and of course, there are many folks who feel like we're dealing with some issues that would be very relevant and probably inspire a lot of thinking and dialogue from him right now, particularly the idea of the other.
Yes.
And otherness, as we have this raging immigration debate. How do you think Elie Wiesel would be responding to the immigration debate that we're having at the present moment?
Well, I don't speak for him. I don't dare to speak for him, but I'm certainly inspired by certain things that he said. And about immigration, he reflected on his own experience as a stateless refugee for many years. He told the story about how his family lost their papers in Hungary. They were ordered to report to a certain place and bring their official state identity papers, and they showed up, and the officials in charge took their papers and tore them to pieces in front of the family's face. And from then on, he was a stateless refugee until he was given immigrant status and ultimately full citizenship in the United States. He said, no human being is illegal. I think that's a bedrock principle to address this question. And when we lose compassion for immigrants and refugees who are fleeing violence or terrible conditions, we've lost our moral compass.
And so what do you do now? What do you take from all of that and now make it into your life's work to keep going in the same vein?
Well, I'm trying to really carry his message and his voice and his wisdom everywhere I go and share it with people, because he was a globe-trotting Nobel Prize winner who's getting phone calls from presidents and prime ministers. But he met with every student in his class for at least 10 minutes in the semester one-on-one. We can use his voice right now, perhaps more than ever. We need wisdom. We need good questions and good tools to reflect on where we are, how we got here, where we might go next. And then in smaller ways, I try to be a better father and husband and friend and son to my parents. And I really work on myself, like a lot of us. And I do that inspired by Elie Wiesel's voice and things that he said to me in private conversations.
Teacher, artist, and author of the new book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom, Rabbi Ariel Berger, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
To see a list of Rabbi Berger's so-called Ten Commandments of Elie Wiesel, go to our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, Chef Lydia Bastianich's culinary tour of rural America and some holiday recipes. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The holiday season for many of us means traditions, especially when it comes to what we eat this time of year. Chef Lydia Bastianich traveled the United States to learn about some of these traditions, and those lessons, combined with her own immigrant experiences, are part of her new holiday special from PBS. It's titled Lydia Celebrates America, a Heartland Holiday Feast, and it premieres tonight on PBS Channel 2. Joining us from New York is Lydia Bastianich. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Lydia.
Thank you. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
So you've been traveling the country for these holiday season specials, sort of celebrating America. Well, why do it with these programs?
This is a special that I do once a year for PBS. I am discovering America. I am an immigrant, and, you know, America is made of immigrants. You know, it's a great country, a strong country. We're all together. And yet, there's so much diversity within America. And I'm just discovering it bit by bit. And food is my way into everybody's kitchen, everybody's home.
Yeah, you're always invited, right? I mean,
absolutely. You know, you talk food and people kind of relax and open the door, hopefully, and set the table up.
This year, you visit parts of rural America, and you begin in a place that has a very special connection for you in Sunbury, Pennsylvania.
Yes, Sunbury, Pennsylvania was a little town right on the Susquehanna that I spent my sophomore year in high school there, the Sunbury High School. You know, I came as a 13-year-old immigrant. I came from Italy, and in Italy, I spent a lot of time with grandma and sort of out in the suburbs with, she had her chickens and her ducks and the pigs and whatever. And so when I came to big city, New York, as amazing as it was a bit overwhelming. So my mother thought that it would do me good to go visit some distance cousin in Sunbury, Pennsylvania, and maybe do a year there. And I did. And I had a great time, and I have great memories. So I thought, you know, I'm going to go back there and see how my family's doing and how the neighborhood is doing, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of food did you make when you were there? That's the first question.
Well, you know, when I first went there, you know, Sumter, Pennsylvania is not too far from Dutch country or the Amish and all of that. So when I was there, I remember my cousins used to take me and eat things like, you know, shoe fly pie and succotash and all of that. These were all new things for me. But they remained in me. And still to this day, you don't find shoe fly pie in New York, I don't think. But go back there and you find it. And we kind of found Debbie, this wonderful woman in Dutch country, that showed me how to make shoe fly pie. And now I really know how to make it, not only eat it, not only say, you know, shoe fly pie. The amazing thing was, I said, so what does shoe have to do with the pie? But then Debbie explained to me, because shoe fly pie is made out of molasses, sticky, it would always attract a lot of fly. So they will shoo the fly off the pie. And that's how it got its name, shoo fly.
Okay, well, A, I need you to explain to our listeners what shoo fly pie is, aside from molasses, and B, how did you make it?
Well, she first made a crust, like a regular crust, some dough, some butter, some brown sugar, made the crust and made some crumbled as well. And then cooked the molasses with sugar, with some butter, and again, the flour. And that was the filling, but it was more like a loose filling when it was poured in. And then the crumbs, you know, like you do an apple crumb pie, the crumbs were put on top, and then that is baked until the liquid the settles in the pie, and then you have to let it rest, and that's shoe fly pie. Very sticky, very sweet, delicious, very different.
So tell me, what were some of the surprising recipes that you heard about in some of these rural communities? In Louisiana, you learned how to make filet. And what is that?
Right. From Pennsylvania, we went down to Louisiana. That's a very kind of mixed culture. You know, it's French, it's Spanish, it's African, American, Indian. Yeah, gumbo, I wanted, you know, I ate it many times, so I had to make it. And filet is an herb. It's leaves of the sassafras tree. And they pick it off, let it dry, and they crumble it into this fine, dry mixture. Like for us Italian, it would be oregano. And it was really wonderful to see, you know, how all of these different cultures ended up into the Creole cooking traditions that are today.
You also, you had some eel.
Oh, yeah, but the eel was up in, it's Walker, Minnesota, this lake, and it was completely frozen. And the lake almost looked like a little town because everybody had their little kind of fishing house. I guess at this time of the year, the eel begins to move and look for a mate, and that's a good fishing time. So I brought my grandson, Miles, who's a fisherman, loves fishing, and we ended up actually catching an eel pout. It's really a codfish. It resembles a codfish, but it's really ugly, and it's delicious. We made fritters right on the ice. And there, the culture goes back to the Norwegians, the Swedes. Even the fishermen, they look like Vikings, red beards, but they were three, four, five generation Americans. And it was, you know, amazing to see how they still keep their sort of Scandinavian traditions.
I wonder where the tradition of kissing the fish came from. Did you really kiss the fish, Lydia?
I did.
Why? Whose tradition is that, to kiss the eel?
I don't know. Either they con me or it is a real tradition, but I kissed that eel.
What was the purpose of kissing the eel, were you told?
I don't know. I guess it's the first eel and you're supposed to kind of congratulate or celebrate the moment.
So what would you say was some of the more surprising things, maybe the most surprising thing, if there is one, that you learned on this sort of rural culinary tour of America?
You know, what was really what I found very interesting is when I went to Lawton, Oklahoma, what was interesting there, I had a chance to kind of meet and even cook out, if you will, in the outpost with the Buffalo Soldiers Association. Now, the Buffalo Soldiers, after the Emancipation Proclamation, there was a lot of young African-American that needed a job, that wanted to be part of the American Army. And so the American Army set this frontier kind of post that was called the Buffalo Soldiers, and they were all Afro-American soldiers. We actually went out and cooked on the open hearth and salted pork and corn cake and beans, and we made coffee on the day. So it was that I really enjoyed, because, you know, as I came here as a young immigrant, I watched a lot of those cowboy Indian movies, and you would see the cowboys and the Indians, whatever, the cowboys cooking out there. And so now I got a chance to really experience that.
Hmm. And you had Mexican tamales, and you had a pork dish that was made from some members of the Hmong community. Really varied experiences.
It is. I mean, we're looking for the diversity of the different cultures and how they ultimately become American and settling to America, and how this is what makes America really very special and very strong, is that, you know, we're all American, a strong country, and yet within this very strong country, we are allowed to sort of be who we are ethnically. And that doesn't happen in any other country.
Hmm. Well, I mean, and there are some people who might argue that it's changing here. You know, this is a difficult climate for folks who are coming into this country, for immigrants in particular. There's a raging debate going on. I'm wondering, with that being the backdrop, you know, how important is food as a way to bond people? Can it really be done in the environment that we're in right now?
You know, yes, there's a bit of a turmoil of that's going on. I think that there's the strength of these different ethnicities and belonging all to the great country that is America. And certainly the table and food is a glue, an element that binds us in a sense. I always thought that food diplomacy should be part of how they discuss diplomacy at the UN. Sit down, have a meal, eat each other's meal, and you'll understand better each other's cultures. And then maybe you can begin to reason, because, you know, food has a positive connotation. So definitely, you know, I think that us getting to know our neighbors, getting to know through their food is one way. That's what I'm doing. I think food is a way to connect, is a glue that really pulls us together if we share it.
So I wonder what's on your holiday table this year, and did your table adapt at all because of this trip around America?
Well, it always, you know, when you go out and you learn and you like things, there's always something that remains. Every trip leaves me with something that I want to try when I get back home into my kitchen. The succotash. Now, do you know what succotash is? Succotash is a Dutch kind of Pennsylvania Dutch or whatever. And it is a combination of lime, beans, and corn, all fresh, those kind of shelled pod, if you will, goodies. We have something similar in Italy. Again, a mixture of peas, but we put artichokes, favas, and all of that. So I kind of combine. I put corn. Those two are two dishes that kind of parallel each other. And I kind of made a combination of both of them.
Mm. What are the sort of the three mainstays of your holiday table this year, your tradition?
Well, for me, it's Christmas, and it's Christmas Eve. It's a big part of the holiday, celebrating the fish. And of course, we have to have our bacala and our fried calamari, some pasta with seafood, whether it's mixed seafood, whether it's just clams. And then, of course, the braised fish, but bacala is a must.
And that's for Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve. The Christmas Day, it's a very festive day. Lots of meat. Because, you know, meat was not all that abundant in Europe, at least when I grew up. And so when a holiday came about, Christmas was about pork. And usually grandma had two porks and, you know, she slaughtered them. And pork was part of the main, and roast. Roast was very much. And then, of course, quince. We had quince apple. We roasted the quince apple. So I remember a lot of roasting in the oven. And I kind of mimic that. I love using the oven and all the smells that come out of it. In the beginning, there's an antipasto, of course, and that's kind of a lot of affettati, prosciutto, mortadella, grana padano, all of that cheese, olives, and some salads. Mm. And the pasta part is the little stuffed pasta, tortellini, agnolini, or homemade pasta. So I'm going to have that this year as well.
Lydia Bastiana, chef, TV host, author, and restaurateur. Her latest television special is Lydia Celebrates America, a Heartland Holiday Feast. It airs tonight on PBS Channel 2. Lydia, thanks so much. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays to you and to your listeners.
And you can find some of the recipes from Lydia's journey at our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.